Thanks, Delia. Good morning, everybody. What a nice audience response. Thanks. I want to thank Katie for a great overview, and I want to thank Hannah for really describing and working on one of the most elegant natural experiments in addressing racial disparities that I've ever seen in our field, and it's been a treat to work with all three of you. What I want to do today is review some of our historical and quite tortuous struggles in finding solutions to racial disparities and STDs, and importantly, what's our role as STD professionals in addressing them. And I also want to offer some action steps for hopefully everybody in this room, whether you're an epidemiologist, a researcher, a provider, or an STD program manager or staffer. And this isn't meant to be a comprehensive list of action points. What I want to do is simply give you some action points, some take-home messages that we can all go home and do today. So we've been talking for more than 100 years about racial disparities and STD rates, and we certainly got off as a field on the wrong foot. We went back and we found the first record that we could find of addressing racial disparities and STDs, and this is from an article published in JAMA. Quite prestigious, and the article is completely overflowing with bigotry and puts all responsibility on syphilis, on the African American community itself for the high rates of syphilis there. And as you can see, the other bias that this statement, that this article reveals, is putting the entire solution for addressing racial disparities in the laboratory and in healthcare services rather than in the schools. John Kennedy, was the General Secretary of the National Medical Association, made up of African American physicians around the country. He worked at Tuskegee as the resident physician, and he also happened to be Booker T. Washington's personal physician. And 40 years after the first publication came out, he pointed out that in fact, if we can improve economic and living conditions and equal educational facilities, the Negro syphilitic rate can be brought into conformity with that of his white neighbors. And he clearly recognized that the solution to disparities wasn't going to be found just in the lab, but in addressing social determinants. So I want to flash forward now 50 years to probably the worst meeting I ever went to in HIV prevention, and I've been to an awful lot of them. And this was a meeting back in 1993 where the CDC invited very conservative critics of HIV prevention efforts to ask them, as well as those of us working in prevention, what we could do to fight AIDS. And they asked a representative from the Family Research Council what we could do to fight AIDS. And what he responded was, it's time to acknowledge that men having sex with men is in and of itself a high-risk behavior, which ought to be strongly discouraged by public policy. And then he went on to say, we need to send all gay men to reparative therapy to turn them straight. So much for using data, never mind ethics, to drive our program. And it was with great disappointment that I read just last week that in Texas, they're now debating sending people to reparative therapy again. What we learn from history is we don't learn from history. So as if that wasn't bad enough in the meeting, the facilitator then turned to those of us working in prevention, and we had the following dialogue. The facilitator asked, what can we do to fight AIDS? And the response came, we need to fight homophobia and racism. How are we going to do that, she asked? By giving our agencies more money. And what are we going to do with that money? Fight homophobia and racism. The point is that we still talk about racial disparities, and we've certainly gotten much better at the language we use than we did back in 1910, but we're still profoundly stuck about what to do about them and what our role is. So now I want to flash forward to just last month in the MMWR that came out, which probably most of you read, about increases in primary and secondary syphilis. And the problem statement was laid out very clearly, and it addressed social determinants, racial ethnic disparities in reported syphilis persisted during 2005-13, likely reflecting social determinants of health. But look at the solutions that were offered up in the MMWR. Providers should counsel, we should promote syphilis awareness and screening, and we should notify and treat sex partners. The solutions were to do the same things we've always done throughout our field and had nothing to do with addressing the social determinants they had just called out. So right now we put most of our resources into services for the people in whom we see the biggest disparities, and we do very little about addressing the disparities themselves. So just imagine the impact of what a little investment in using policy could do to address the determinants, and maybe we could just tip the scales in our efforts to address disparities. And there's a lot we can do to address policy, and I want to name just a few steps. First of all, for those of you who are epidemiologists and researchers, as Katie's described, the data are incredibly convincing that disparities exist, and they're not due to behavioral differences between African Americans and other populations. So we need you epidemiologists to join us in moving upstream. And there are some important debates going on right now that we need epidemiologists and researchers to inform. As Katie showed, 30% of African American men will at some point end up in the criminal justice system. That has a strong impact on gender ratios, which then has a strong impact on concurrency, which can then lead to more STDs. And we need better documentation of this. Some of us call it a hypothesis, some of us believe more strongly in it, to help inform correctional policies. And when policies change, such as recent reductions in crack cocaine sentencing disparities, we need epidemiologists to understand what that can do for STD and HIV transmission. The second debate we need epidemiologists and researchers help on is PrEP. PrEP is a wonderful, fabulous new tool that we have for HIV prevention. But there are a number of big questions that remain. One is, what's the population level impact it's going to have? And secondly, we already know that African Americans are faring worse on the treatment cascade for HIV, and we need to be able to carefully track what the impact of PrEP is going to be on disparities. How is it going to affect them? Is it going to make it better? Is it going to make it worse? And you can answer. So now I want to turn to those of you who are medical providers or healthcare providers in the room. And there's a lot you can do to address policy. Some of that's inside the clinic and address disparities. Some of that's inside the clinic and some of that's outside. Let's start with inside. A lot of us aren't conducting risk assessments of any kind with our patients. And when I was at StopAIDS, we taught hundreds and hundreds of volunteers to go up to people they'd never met and ask them the most intimate questions about their sex lives. It's really not that hard. While asking about condom use is useful, we also need to be asking about basic network concepts and translate it to the right down to the individual conversation. We need to be asking, how many partners do you have, where do you meet your partners, and what do you know about your partner's risk? You're also talking to patients every day, and those personal stories that you collect can be incredibly important in affecting policy. We all have a deep commitment to quantitative data, but let's not forget the impact that we've seen over and over again in this country by bringing an individual, personal, poignant story to Congress or to the legislature in your own jurisdiction and thinking about what difference those personal stories can make. Secondly, you yourselves, a lot of you have MDs at the end of your name. I have a D at the beginning of mine. I deeply wish sometimes there was one at the end. But you have a lot of credibility in policy circles, and you shouldn't underestimate it. The skills you have can be transferred to work in policy, and many people have gone on and already addressed their legislatures in some way. Can I just get a show of hands of how many of you talk to your legislature about your work? That's absolutely terrific. Look around if you haven't raised your hand and learn from those others, and to the others of you who are raising your hands, I hope you'll help the others out. The skills aren't that hard. You can learn them. Now I want to address those of you who are working in STD programs. The best way of explaining PICSI program, coordination and service integration. The best definition I ever heard came from Susan Delisle at the CDC, who said that wherever a person comes into our system, whether they're looking for HIV, STD, TB, or HEP services, we need to offer them comprehensive care for all of them. We need to learn from PICSI and make sure that wherever anybody comes into our system, we also help them get enrolled in health care coverage. For millions of African Americans who haven't had coverage up to now, the ACA Affordable Care Act holds great promise for meeting many of their medical needs and healthcare needs. The new funding stream for the CDC, APPS, contains explicit encouragement for us to work on policy, and it's really up to us whether we choose to address policies that concentrate on providing services or we address those that can affect determinants themselves. And while you can't lobby using federal funds or state funds, there's a lot you can do to educate policymakers. And I want to give the CDC a lot of praise for having on their website a terrific webinar on what we can do to affect policy, and the National Coalition of STD Directors can also help. Right now, many of our health departments are siloed profoundly. We have communicable diseases on one side, and we have chronic diseases on the other. Face it, we all face the same social determinants. We don't need somebody from one person from our communicable disease department to go to the African-American community and talk about STDs, and another to go talk to them about asthma. We need to stop working separately and start coordinating our efforts. Another tool we have are health impact assessments. These assessments help get policymakers who are working on urban planning, who are working on education, who are working on labor laws to start taking health into account. Carolyn Fichtenberg and her colleagues at Johns Hopkins did a great quantitative and qualitative analysis of how zoning changes would affect Baltimore. And one of their findings was that alcohol outlets would increase substantially in high poverty neighborhoods. They didn't model out the impact on STDs, but hopefully somebody else in this room can. We in California, like other states, have identified a number of hotspots, geographic areas where we see high cases of gonorrhea among African Americans. So what we've done is start talking to organizations who are working on social determinants around the state and in these hotspots, and what we're learning to find out two things. One, what are the explanations they have for why rates are so high, and what are the policy areas that they're working on that we might be able to help inform and collaborate on. And we've heard lots of stories about how there's too many alcohol outlets, there's too many people in prison, there's too many kids dropping out of school, and there's too many people in housing, public housing projects, which often have a lot of single-parent families, a lot of unsupervised time, and they're just not that healthy. One of the things we've learned from these conversations, the importance of finding new bedfellows. We've learned that by talking to people who work outside our comfort zone of sexual health, we can learn a lot, whether we're talking to activist groups such as ACT UP, the NAACP, businesses such as pharmacies, or even the United States Federal Reserve Bank, which it turns out has a whole lot of projects going on around community development, and we should be learning from them, and working together, we can move us ahead. So now, some action steps for all of us. First, let's admit we have a problem. We're still talking too much about disparities, and we're fervently hoping that if we just do a better job of providing STD services, or we leave it to others to tackle the upstream determinants, these disparities will go away. The other thing we can all do is learn from Bill Haddon. Bill Haddon was a physician and epidemiologist, and he was also the first chief of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And 50 years ago, he mandated that auto manufacturers include seatbelts when they were building cars. And he said he didn't have a randomized control trial to base that decision on, but he felt it was the right thing to do. And although it was one of the hardest decisions he made, it ended up saving thousands of lives, and he was proud of the decision he made. And the point is, we shouldn't let narrow definitions of evidence hinder us from pursuing the vision of social justice that called many of us to pursue this work in the first place. Let's not hold ourselves back from contributing what we know to changing housing programs, sentencing laws, and building more equity in schools. Finally, we've all been to a lot of presentations where we talk about STDs and our clinical and our behavioral challenges and the disparities we face. And almost as an afterthought, we mentioned in the last slides that we're also addressing, or we need to address, social determinants. Let's not wait till the last slide. If we're going to talk about racial disparities and social determinants, let's do something about them. With that, I want to thank you all, and I want to thank Aaron Cavanaugh, my colleagues at the STD Control Branch in California, Steve Terrett at Johns Hopkins, and the best group of colleagues I've ever had the pleasure of putting a panel discussion on with. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you to the whole group of speakers for a wonderful set of overviews and presentations. We'd now like to open the floor to audience comments and questions, and the panelists are up here. So are there any further thoughts on this issue or questions about their talks? And the mics are in the aisles.
Hi, Beth Meyerson from Indiana University, former SDDA's director back in the day. Lovely, wonderful, yay, like should have happened a bazillion years ago panel, love it. The question to the group really is, Dan is likely the only person I know funded by STD money that does policy work. Maybe I'm wrong now. Who is getting STD funding and financing staff to do policy work? One, two, three. Okay, three. Not enough. I teach at the School of Public Health. We barely have time in our curriculum for public policy, and that's all very erudite and not action-oriented. So I think what we need to be about is a new agenda on capacity development for practitioners as well as up-and-coming students. We're going to have to really think about this and put some national resource together, take a page from maybe HIV's playbook, but start to invest. So I just want to thank you for raising these issues, giving us some interesting tools, some ways to think about it. But I want to challenge us all that we need to be much more active to push the envelope and put some, you know, skin in the game. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes. Hi, my name is Ebony Joyner. Over here.
Okay. Sorry.
I work with a community-based organization in Philadelphia, the Youth Outreach Adolescent Community Awareness Program. My question is around the housing development study that you did. It's a two-part question, I think. Some of the results that you got from relocating some of the people who lived in the housing developments, do you think that they had anything to do with some of the positive changes, had anything to do with any information that they got from changing their attitudes, beliefs, behaviors, learning about some of the activities that they were doing that put them at risk other than just relocating from the housing development? Because a lot of times you can move in different places, but if you still had the same attitudes, beliefs, behaviors, and are surrounded by the same environment in your home, your network, you would still have the same problems. So my question is, do you think that that had anything to do with some of the positive changes that you found once people relocated?
Sure, that's a great question. Thank you. So one of the things I loved about Katie's presentation was this idea of a kind of a multi-level approach. And I do really firmly believe that the public housing relocations, to the extent that they had positive outcomes, that it was because of many different changes that were happening simultaneously as a result of moving. So what we captured in our analyses really was about the impacts of neighborhood change, but there are also, I think, major changes in people's social networks that happen post-relocation, sexual networks, and also maybe there are just some individual-level attitudes, depression, substance misuse, so behaviors. So I think that all of those things might have been at play in shaping some of the outcomes. And we have data on that, and we're just kind of beginning to explore that, but that's a great question. Yeah.
Next question.
Good morning. My name is Karen Krasinowski from Michigan. I just wanted to make a follow-up comment to the professor who spoke from the School of Public Health about policy. I didn't raise my hand because I didn't want to get crosswise with our cooperative agreement. But we do have staff that work on policy. But I must say that the language in our cooperative agreement is such a wet blanket that people are afraid to get active. And really where we need to be doing our advocacy work is in Congress, because why do we have boilerplate language like that that prevents citizens from really communicating and doing policy work, especially in public health, when policy is one of the fundamental functions of public health? And then real quickly, National Coalition of STD Directors does have a very good program for people who have no experience in policy development, and I would encourage people to look at that. And also the CDC does fund the Directors of Health Promotion and Education for their curriculum called Shaping Policy for Health, which was developed by the University of North Carolina Gilling School. And I would encourage people to Google Shaping Policy for Health because that's a wonderful resource.
Thank you. That's great to know. Thanks so much.
So my question comment is related to the relocation. So I'm in Iowa. That's probably strange for an STD conference, but we do have STDs out there. So the relocation conversation is interesting to someone out in Iowa because we don't have big cities that people relocate within. We get people that are relocating from big cities outside of the state. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas how that might be impacting both the people that are relocating into these rural areas, small towns with very little resources. In Iowa's case, I think we've gone from 97% white to 93% white in about 15 years, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot when you're talking about a town of 15,000. And then the impact of the community that is experiencing this relocation.
That's a great question. If I had the answer, you know, I would be a superstar. But I have a couple of thoughts. So the first is that often in research on place characteristics and health, we treat places as pretty static. And we kind of assume that people stay where they are and that's kind of where they've always been. So it's been relatively recently that we've understood that places are dynamic, cities change, and that people move within cities and kind of across state lines, and that those moves and those kind of urban changes may actually have profound effects on health. So this is still a new area, which is a sad thing to say. But the research that's been done so far kind of says that it's not only the kind of relocation itself that matters, but it's the quality of where you started and where you moved to. So looking at poverty rates or social cohesion, and then also how receptive the communities are to you when you arrive. That was one concern that came up with some of the public housing relocators is, you know, would their communities accept them after they moved, or would there be a lot of stigma attached to, you know, being from the public housing complexes? And that has, I think, happened in some counties. But yeah, we haven't really learned enough about that, and that's kind of sad.
And it is a little bit of a loaded question. The NAACP has found that Iowa is the worst rate of incarceration for black men in the country.
Okay.
So that's good to part know. Of the answer, I think.
Sure.
We just have a couple of minutes left, so maybe one more question here and one there. So go ahead, Steve.
I mean, mine. I want to say something to Dan, but I'll come up afterwards.
Okay.
Steve Saunders, New Jersey Department of Health, HIV Prevention Director, and I did want to. One quick comment that in our CDC HIV Prevention Cooperative Agreement, we're required to work on policy development. And my question is for the housing, the relocation study. Were you able to collect and tease out any data on MSM in particular? And were the results either, were they strikingly different from the general population?
That's a great question. I can tell you that we did gather data on MSM and also on women who had sex with women, but the numbers were too small to actually do any sub-analyses. At least insofar as people were willing to tell us. Yeah.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you to the audience for those great questions.